Welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. Happy New Year and welcome to 2023, Mr. Rambo.
Thanks, John. Happy New Year to you too, and also all of our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have some big plans for the show this year. I think it's going to be a great year for Stack Trace. We're definitely going to try to do more episodes than what we did towards the end of the last year, because I think both me and you were really, really busy there towards the end of the year, like a lot of people are, right? Like there's a lot of projects wrapping up. You want to get things done before the holidays. You want to ship some new things. And you don't want to do it too close to the holidays either, because you don't want to end up with that nasty bug that sneaks its way into production. And then, well, your holidays are ruined, right?
Yeah, exactly. My yearly schedule in terms of like when I take a bigger vacation type break, I've inherited that from my family, I guess, because at least here, most families take their vacation around the holidays and they travel during the holidays and things like that. But I've never been into that. So I'm taking my actual vacation next week and the week after that. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And that means, of course, that during the holidays, I was just working, basically.
Yeah, it is a pretty neat way to do things if, you know, your schedule works out that way, that you're able to take time off when most other people don't have time off, because usually you can get cheaper flights, like you can get better vacation in general, like, you know, nicer deals on hotels and things like that. And it's not as crowded as if you go to some really popular destination when everyone else is also on holiday, right?
Yeah.
So I've also tried to do that. I think both me and you, we have pretty flexible schedules in terms of our work and so on. So I've also tried to do that a lot in the past, is to try to not schedule my vacations when everyone else is also on vacation.
Absolutely. Best deal ever if you do that.
Right. So we wanted to kick off this first episode of 2023 by actually talking a little bit about a Apple rumor, because we haven't been talking so much about rumors around what Apple might be up to lately on the show. And it's kind of funny because this is how the show started. It started back in your spelunking days, Rambo, when we were doing things like the Rambo Report and really kind of diving deep on the rumors and what you had discovered and so on regarding what Apple might be up to.
Yep.
But of course, over time, we've been mixing things up a little bit and doing more, talking about our own projects and learnings from those, and talking more about coding and things like that, and, you know, sprinkling in a little bit of different things as well. Sometimes we have John's gaming corner, sometimes we have John's Static Site Generation corner, or our Swift UI corner, which I think will make another appearance here in this episode. We will see. But let's get back and talking about some rumors here, because I feel like both of us, we don't really feel like we need to comment on every single rumor that happens these days, because I don't know about you, Rambo, but I feel like if you're trying to follow all the Apple rumors these days, it can kind of be a little bit exhausting because there's just so many rumors going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've talked about this before, where I'm not really into following this stuff too closely, or at least not considering it valuable information in most cases, unless it's very likely something that's very clear and that will affect my work somehow, then I'm paying attention and paying more attention. But I never do like any decision based on rumors or stress out about rumors that much, because I do see some people, they get stressed out just because of rumors, and I don't think that's very healthy. So I try to limit my exposure to them.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And also, if you're using rumors as a basis for buying decisions, that can really be stressful, right?
Yep.
Because you're always hunting for that perfect time to buy your computer. And it's usually like such a time is very, very hard to predict, because you don't know. Sometimes you buy a new machine and then like the next week some better option comes out. But by using the rumors, you can, of course, make a little bit more educated guesses around when it might be a good idea versus not to buy something new. So I totally understand why people do that. And I do that as well. Like before I buy something, I try to check like, okay, when was the last revision of this particular product released? So there's no chance that I, you know, will fall into that trap of buying something, especially if it's something more expensive. And then like just a few weeks later, something better comes out that I could have gotten instead.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sunk cost fallacy kind of thing, right? Because you are waiting to buy it at the perfect time, and then the more you wait, the less perfect the time seems to buy that thing, and then you exactly. just wait forever, and you just you're basically your purchase is deadlocked at that point.
Exactly. So what is this rumor then we want to talk about? Well, I thought it would be fun to talk about the latest rumors around the Mac Pro. And this is not really a computer that I think any of us is really in the market for, because especially in the latest couple of revisions, the Mac Pro has really been like a very, very high-end product. I mean, the most high-end product that Apple sells pretty much. So it's not something that you and I are considering really for our work, because I think both of us are now using the latest MacBook Pros and we're very happy with those. But as we talked about on the last episode of 2022, I recently built my own gaming PC, and this kind of opened my mind up a little bit to the idea of modular computing. And I really had a good time putting that PC together, and I've been really having a good time using it, as we also talked about on the last episode. But also it's really gotten me thinking more around like, how would it work if Macs were more modular again, like they used to be? And the Mac Pro kind of still is very modular, at least the 2019 version of it was. And the rumors are now, if we look at Mark Gurman's latest Power On newsletters, he's been talking about the Mac Pro. And it seems like the current kind of rumors and what Apple might be doing with it is that the new Mac Pro will look identical to the 2019 model, but it won't support user upgradable RAM. But it will, according to these rumors at least, feature user upgradable SSDs and PCIe slots where you can put things like third-party GPUs, accelerator cards, well, other kinds of accelerator cards, networking cards, sound cards, whatever you might want to upgrade your PC with, or your Mac in this case, I guess. And there was also some rumors a while back that the new Mac Pro would feature like a M2 Extreme kind of version of Apple's SoCs, where there would be two M2 Ultras kind of joined together, just like how an M2 Ultra is two M2 Maxes joined together. Do I get that right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, there's a puzzle here going on, right? Like where they're joining these chips together. But that seems to have been scrapped. So it seems like the new Mac Pro will have an M2 Ultra, but what will make it different from the Mac Studio, which also uses the Ultra version of the M1 currently, is that the Mac Pro will be user upgradable to some extent. So I wanted to hear your thoughts about this, Rambo. Like, as someone who isn't really into modular computing at the moment, as far as I know. I mean, you're tinkering with a lot of hardware, but none of your computers that you're using is like something that you've put together with modules. I guess so you have some Raspberry Pis and things like that. But what do you think about these latest rumors around the Mac Pro and it having some amount of modularity even as it moves to Apple Silicon?
Yeah, you mentioned something that I never really defined myself in any way with regards to this topic, but yeah, I would say I'm definitely not into modular computing or other modular products like smartphones and things like that. And that's why I sometimes have a bit of a thing, not against necessarily, but I'm not really into the very extreme approach of right to repair stuff that's been going on around the world. Like, I definitely agree with many of the things that are being defended in that regard, but not the extreme approach where everything is modular and you can change the chip on your iPhone if you want to. And the reason why is because I believe this stuff is a choice between different trade-offs, and Apple chooses trade-offs that work for them and that they believe the customers want. I don't think Apple makes the chip solder to the motherboard of the iPhone just because they want to make more money on repairs. Like, that's a that's a consequence, of course, but I think there's other trade-offs in there, and in general, those trade-offs tend to align with what I like about products in terms of design and size and other things like that, and reliability, of course. When it comes to computers, I'm mostly the same these days. Things have changed a lot since back in the day. I definitely changed my mind on this as technology evolved. So I definitely am not that interested in modularity in the sense of what a Mac Pro could offer, but I do think it's interesting to think about the different trade-offs that Apple will make for this Mac Pro to allow for a more modular design, because there's no magic in terms of separating components that are currently fused together while having the same performance characteristics. Like, something has to give in that balance, and it's going to be interesting to see if they do this, how they achieve that, and what the trade-offs are when you are using external GPUs and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can kind of place the trade-off as being between really high-end performance and efficiency. I think efficiency is probably a better term, because you can definitely achieve the same level of performance with a modular system as with a tightly coupled or integrated one. It just requires more headroom. It requires, well, more kind of just raw compute, right? Yep. While when you have an integrated system, like a system on a chip, like the M series of chips, then you can kind of optimize everything really down to the atoms, if you will, like, you know, down to the nanometers that are on the chip.
Yeah.
With things like the unified memory architecture, for example, where both the CPU and the GPU can draw and read and write from the same memory pool, which is really not feasible or, you know, really possible if you're building something that is a truly modular system, like my gaming PC, for example, which definitely does not have a unified memory architecture. It has a pool of RAM that sits on the motherboard, and then the CPU is basically interacting with that, and the GPU has its own VRAM, and then there's just transfers between the two, right? So kind of a very classic setup that Apple also used to use before they built this unified memory architecture. And on the other hand, so you have that efficiency on the other, on one scale, on one side of the scale, and then I would say you have flexibility on the other one, where you have complete control, or at least some degree of control, over what components goes into your system. And perhaps more crucially, you can replace them over time. And I think, like, this is really where it's interesting when you look at something like the Mac Pro, where it seems like some parts, like GPUs, for example, will be replaceable, and SSDs, while the RAM will not, which I think is, you know, what you're kind of alluding to there, where Apple has made the choice, or if we believe this rumor, that is, that having that unified memory architecture and having the RAM be directly on the SoC and not having any kind of sources of external RAM gives the best performance, or gives the best kind of system stability for the M2 or the Apple Silicon family of chips.
Yeah, and since the design itself, I think, is fairly consolidated by it this time, and there aren't like huge changes in terms of the shape of ports and cards that can go into machines. Another aspect of modularity that is not talked about very much when it comes to the Mac Pro, and that I would like to see, would be modularity in terms of the actual case itself, where maybe when the new model comes out, like a new chip, you will have to change the whole logic board because that's all integrated, but you could, like, you could just get a new logic board for your existing Mac Pro and swap it, or have an Apple Store swap it for you, because that's where I do have a problem. If the case is the same, which might be the case, no pun intended, with the Mac Pro, why not? Like, let people keep the same case they already have, which already has the different cards in there, and just swap out the logic board. Of course, that's not feasible in a MacBook Pro or even a Mac Mini, any of these super integrated machines where absolutely everything is soldered to the logic board. But couldn't that be possible maybe with the Mac Pro? Because it's such a waste, right? If you already have the Mac Pro, you have the external case, and you have all of the other components you need for your Mac Pro to work, and it's just a new chip that came out, but the format, like the physical format of the logic board, is the same, and the power requirements are the same, or even less than the current one. Couldn't you buy a new logic board and put it in there? That's something a modular Mac Pro could offer without allowing you to have separate RAM and separate GPU and things like that.
Yeah, and this is interesting, right? Because now we're getting closer and closer to that kind of full modularity that I have, for example, in my gaming PC, right? Where I could swap out the motherboard if I wanted to. But like you said there, like the motherboard or the logic board, I guess it's called in the case of Macs, right? It also influences some of the other components, like, for example, the power supply. Like, probably, like you said, the Apple Silicon version of the new Mac Pro will draw less power because Apple Silicon is very power efficient. But maybe that won't be true for the M3 or M4. Maybe they will actually increase the power envelope to be able to gain even more power. That would make sense in something like a Mac Pro, which is a big tower stationary computer where you can just draw more power than in a laptop. So it's not as easy, I would say, as to just like have a slot and say, here, you can just slot in a logic board, because some other components might also need to change. But I agree. I mean, I would love to see Apple in general offer something that is more kind of a build your own Mac type of solution that is not just the Mac Pro, because like I said in the beginning here, I don't think I would, I don't want to say ever, but currently I don't see myself buying a Mac Pro because I just can't justify that expense for the work that I do. And I really like having a laptop for work and so on. But if there was a more kind of entry level way to get into building a custom Mac, I would love to do that because, like I've said, it's been incredibly satisfying building my own PC and also having a system that you've just tailored exactly to how you want it to be, where you have picked exactly the type of components you want to use. And you've made all those trade-offs also on a kind of component by component basis when you decide, do I spend more of my money on my CPU or on my GPU? Do I opt for more RAM, or what do I want to choose to spend my budget on, and how do I fit it all together? Like that I've felt like is incredibly cool and great to be able to do that. And being able to do that for something like a work computer would also definitely be very beneficial for a lot of people, I feel like. But I don't really see Apple ever doing that again, like getting into some kind of mid slash entry level type of machine that is not a Mac Pro where you have modularity. So it will probably be locked behind the Mac Pro price tag, unfortunately. But still, it's interesting to think about because even with Apple Silicon, the way they're moving, I don't think there's really any saying that it would be impossible for the system to be more modular again. And if they do indeed add support for third-party GPUs, I don't really see why that would be conflicting with Apple Silicon, because even with Intel chips, you have integrated GPUs on the chipsets. Like you have those integrated graphics cards that are on the Intel chips. So that's kind of similar to having GPU cores on the system on a chip. It's not exactly the same because an SoC is more like the whole computer, apart from just being a CPU. But it doesn't, I wouldn't say that rules out having third-party GPUs, where if the amount of GPU power you can get on the system on a chip is not sufficient, then adding a third-party GPU on the side of that is kind of similar to how you have a separate GPU in something like a gaming PC, I would say.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think there are some workflows where people need to perform some computation types where they do need a specific GPU model even sometimes. So that would allow that sort of workflow to be done on the Mac. I just question to which extent that's an important market for Apple. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much of like the professional video and audio people they can get with the Mac Studio, because I think that's a really great machine. And in terms of my own interests, I'm way more interested in seeing the complete opposite, basically. I would like to see like the tiniest Mac possible. Like, how small of a Mac could Apple make now that they control the whole thing? Because, like I mentioned, I do like playing around with the Raspberry Pi. And yeah, I would love to see something like the Apple Pi.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I would like to see both ends of the spectrum, right? In an ideal world, I would like there to be like a build your own Mac kit that you can buy, or you can buy separate components from Apple and put together your own Mac, or you could even take macOS and install it on like on PC components, because, well, why not, right? I mean, that's in an ideal world. I don't think those things will happen. Of course, there are Hackintoshes and things like that, but that's definitely not officially supported. But I would also love to see like the really miniaturization that Apple has gotten so good at lately. And definitely, I feel like Apple is more in that camp right now where they want to integrate everything tightly, make it as small and as efficient as it can be, like build everything as one whole system. And like you said in the beginning here, it's a different trade-off to kind of the modular computer world where you take you more favor modularity and flexibility, putting things together rather than just having one tightly integrated system. But that really, like you mentioned there just a moment ago, there's a question of like, who is the Mac Pro for, right?
Yeah.
And the question also then is like, if there is only some amount of upgradability, but not complete upgradability, are the people that would previously be interested in the Mac Pro still interested in it? Like, that's really the big question, I feel like. And since there is the Mac Studio, it seems like maybe the Mac Pro will be kind of a Mac Studio plus, you know, card slots. Is that good enough? I don't know. Like, I'm not sure like exactly what market is interested in a product like this.
Yeah, definitely. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see what they actually come out with.
Yeah, absolutely. But now let's switch gears and talk more about code again, because that's what we love to do on the show lately, is to dive deeper into our own projects and talk about what we've been working on and our learnings from those projects. So Rambo, if we start with you on this episode, I know that you've been doing some interesting things with SwiftUI. So it seems like we're once again entering our SwiftUI corner here. It seems like you've been doing quite a lot of interesting custom layouts lately.
Definitely. Well, more like one custom layout, but in the process of doing that, I have approached it in different ways and figured out what's been working for me. So I think I do have some stuff to share. So I've been working on some new designs for AirBuddy, and one of them involves a layout that I think it would be fair to say it's kind of like a flow layout, where you have different modules, basically different little rectangles, and the rectangles can be of different sizes and they will flow from top to bottom, left to right, and the squares will fill the available space as perfectly as possible, kind of like a little puzzle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It helps that I've seen what this looks like, which of course it's not easy to transmit in podcast form. Perhaps, is it possible to put a screenshot, you feel like, in the chapter art, or is that too secret still?
Well, I can actually do better, because I just remember that there is a part of macOS that uses a layout that's very much what I've been working on, which is Control Center. So right, you can just open Control Center on your Mac. The main Control Center view, where you have like the Wi-Fi and focus modes, that's basically it. So you have different rectangle sizes and they basically fill the space depending on their size. And if you have like a large square, but you have smaller squares next to it, those small squares will flow to its side and fill the bottom row, and it will go like that until all of the space is used and all of the items have been distributed. Would you call that a flow layout? Is that something you'd use a flow layout for in like the collection view sense?
Yeah, you could call it a flow layout. You could also call it like a tile-based layout is probably what I would call it, right? They have different tiles and you can kind of look at it as a grid view in a way also, but a more kind of irregular grid, not that every column is exactly, you know, aligned. Every cell is aligned the exact same, which is more kind of a standard grid layout, I would say. And this is where kind of declarative or very component-driven layouts tend to be sometimes a little bit difficult to work with, where if you're building everything as like its standalone, own separate component, which is definitely something that we try to do when building SwiftUI views. We want our views to be just kind of rendering the data we give them. We don't want them to be aware of any of their siblings and things like that. I mean, it's not really even possible because you can't really pass references to views around, even though you can have them all read from the same model. But here in this kind of layout that you're describing here, where you have these different tiles or you have a flow layout or whatever you want to call it, you kind of need the components or the views, the tiles, to have different sizes depending on what other tiles are next to them, which can sometimes be a little bit challenging when, like I said, when everything is kind of standalone and you don't want things to be aware of each other, but they kind of have to in a layout like this.
Yeah, definitely. So when approaching something like this, I think it's important, and I always think about this when building a layout, be like a more complicated one like this one, but also any layout, I always think about what are the rules, right? So I need to define some rules that will be respected by this UI. And when you think about those rules, you should also think about what type of user content and user customization will be allowed. So will the user be able to rearrange items or resize items? Are there going to be an unlimited potential collection of item sizes with different widths and heights? Or am I supporting just a set of families, kind of like widgets? So all of those things are things you should think about before implementing your approach, because depending on the answers, you might be taking completely different approaches, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in general, I would say that's a good kind of strategy to have whenever you're building any kind of system within an application or an entire application by itself, is to spend a little time up front to, like I said, write down the rules or write down the goals of what you're trying to build here. That will usually really help when you are making these kind of smaller decisions while you're actually coding. You can remember that, oh, right, I need to think about this particular use case, or I need to also make sure that this feature is supported. Of course, you want to strike a nice balance there to not to try to implement everything all at once, because that will usually be kind of difficult if you're doing something complicated. You kind of want to take it step by step and make, you know, A work, then B, then C, and then make A, B, and C all work together. But I absolutely agree that it's a great idea to kind of write down explicitly, especially when doing something like a layout, like, what are the rules here? How do I want it to behave under different situations?
Yeah, definitely. So I defined a bunch of rules. I'm not going to list everything because, first, I don't remember all of them. And second, because it will be too much detail and it will be boring. But in general, my approach was the latter one I mentioned, which is to have different families of items, basically. So I have predefined item sizes that will always be that size. And then I have a collection of modules, basically, and they have a property that's basically what's my family. So you have like the little square, the large square, the medium rectangle. I don't remember the exact names, but I have predefined families. And then based on that, I thought about using the new layout protocol in SwiftUI, which came out this year. But then I remembered that it came out this year. So,
right.
and I want to support at least macOS Monterey with this new UI I'm working on. So, of course, what's left in terms of SwiftUI, at least, is Geometry Reader, right? I have to use a Geometry Reader to read the space available and then perform calculations and position the subviews accordingly. So the approach I took was to implement my layout as a type. So it's a simple struct that will be initialized with the items, and the items conform to a protocol. And I think the only requirement on the protocol is the size, basically. So what's my width and height? And the item will define that based on its family. And then that struct will, upon being initialized, it will be initialized with the collection of items it has and with the container's bounds. And then based on that, it will go and calculate the frame within the container bounds for each of the items. So basically, in my view body, I have a geometry reader. I get the view geometry reader proxy. I initialize the layout with the items, with the proxy bounds. And then I go through each view and set its frame and position with whatever the layout has calculated. So that's worked really well. And I thought about, let me see if there are like any differences between this approach and and the new layout protocol, because I was rewatching the dub session about the new layout protocol, and towards the end of the session, I think the presenter talked about using Geometry Reader as an alternative and how that's what you would do in previous versions of SwiftUI, basically. And then they went on to say how terrible of an idea that is. And I was like, come on, you're telling me that there's this new layout protocol and it's only available in the latest OSs, and now you're telling me that the alternative that I can use for older OSs is terrible. That's not fair.
That's very typical Apple, though, right? Like, yeah. Here's this old technique that you've had to use because of API limitations for years now, And here's a new version, which is way better, and the old one is terrible, right? Like, don't use the old one. And then it's like, okay, but what if I need to support older OS versions? Then I don't have a choice.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is right, and it is correct that this approach using the Geometry Reader is inferior to the layout protocol, and basically, and that's very well explained in the session, it's because with Geometry Reader, you are getting a size that's being offered to you, and with the layout protocol, you can actually participate in the layout engine, basically. So you can be a part of the SwiftUI layout engine, and you can propose sizes, because in SwiftUI, views propose their own sizes, basically. And I'm not going to explain the whole layout engine here, because it's complicated, but that's the gist of it. And what I found is that for my use case, since I already know the sizes of things, because like I mentioned, I have the predefined set of item families and I know all of the items that are going to be shown in this layout, then the Geometry Reader approach works just fine, because I don't need to worry about, oh, what if this suddenly the subview grows and becomes twice as large? I don't have that problem.
Yeah, and the thing is that when we put different solutions against each other like this, it's easy to fall into that narrative, which is like, this is the new solution, it's amazing, it's the best solution, the old one is terrible and you should never use it, right? Yeah. And usually that's not actually the case. Like, Geometry Reader, I feel like, has gotten somewhat of a bad reputation because I think it was really overused in the beginning before really any of us third-party developers really fully understood SwiftUI, where Geometry Reader felt like it was almost like comfort food, right? Like it felt comfortable where it was the thing we knew. It was like you get this view here and inside of it, you can get the geometry and you can just lay out your views however you want. You get more kind of almost imperative layout code again, kind of similar to when you were computing frames or using auto layout constraints, a little bit more similar to that. And I think that's why, I mean, that's why I used it so much in the beginning, because I just kind of didn't know better because I was new to SwiftUI like everyone else. But then over time, when I learned more about the layout system and I realized, you know what, I can express so much more of my layout using more dynamic tools, like things like frame modifiers with minimum and maximum widths. I can use things like offset, or I can use even the stacks and spacers in different ways and configurations, and you know, different kinds of tools that makes it so you don't have to use Geometry Reader so much. Even things that were introduced in iOS 14, if that's something that you can use as a minimum deployment target, which a lot of people can do now, then you can use things like the lazy V and H grids that were introduced. Like, that's another thing you can use to replace a lot of Geometry Reader. So I feel like over time, I personally, and I've seen a lot of other people do the same thing, have been replacing Geometry Readers with more efficient or tools that are better expressing your kind of layout intent and making the layout more dynamic and more kind of integrated into the layout system, like you said, Rambo. But all that being said, there are still situations where I personally use Geometry Reader, and it's kind of similar to my attitude on singletons. It's that I don't use singletons by default. I don't go and make every controller or every like manager object in my app a singleton by default. Instead, sometimes I choose to use a singleton pattern because I feel like it's the best fit for what I'm trying to build. If it's something that is truly global in the app, I want it to be accessible from anywhere without having to pass it around explicitly, I use a singleton. That's fine. But and the same thing is true with Geometry Reader. I use it where I feel like it's the best tool for what I'm trying to build. Like in this case, where you want to build something very flexible in a backward compatible way. But that doesn't mean that I use Geometry Reader everywhere. And I feel like as long as you strike a balance like that, a lot of these tools that people say are bad, like singletons or you know, Geometry Reader or whatever it might be, AnyView is another one of those examples, right? Yeah. As long as you're using it, understanding what the trade-offs are and that you're accepting those trade-offs for what you're trying to build, I feel like that is absolutely fine. And that is how these tools were kind of intended to be used from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't feel bad at all for doing it the way I did, and I think it works really well. And the thing is, I was worried about, when I was doing this with Geometry Reader, I was worried about things like animations and transitions. So when I first did the layout-based implementation, I tested like using mesh geometry effect, because these cards, they can be expanded in like a modal fashion. So everything goes away and just a single card becomes focused and grows up. And I'm using mesh geometry effect for that. And it looked beautiful with the layout protocol and using the layout engine. So I thought maybe when I moved to Geometry Reader, that stuff would break and that would be very sad. But it didn't. It actually just kept working just fine. As long as the views have the right identifiers and things like that, it all just works, trademark. So at the end of the day, I have a little flow layout view, and it is generic over the item type and the item collection type. And it also has an item view, which is the view for each item, because we can't, without the layout protocol, at least create our own containers in SwiftUI. You can using some underscored APIs, but I don't feel good using those in production. So I basically have a little view factory closure that you pass into the initializer for this flow layout view. And in fact, since I wrote my implementation of this layout as a plain old struct, so basically like a model, I am actually using the new layout protocol when you're running on macOS Ventura or later. Because since this is all abstracted away and I have this implemented as a model type, I was able to share the layout implementation between the Geometry Reader-based approach and the new layout protocol-based approach. So I don't have to write the layout calculation twice. It's the exact same layout calculation code. And in the layout protocol-based approach, that just becomes the cache. So the layout has the little cache associated type. So my model became the cache for the layout implementation, and it works just fine in both old and new OSs.
That's awesome. And that's really the power of abstractions, right? When you can come up with something where if you can find a way to kind of express the core functionality of what you're trying to build. And that's also why we so often talk about like trying not to leak implementation details, because if you keep your API simple and focused on what is the actual task that is being performed, in this case, it's like laying out a bunch of views in a tile-based fashion, then the implementation can just be completely abstracted from the call site, which gives you that power of being able to choose, do I use Geometry Reader or the layout protocol, depending on the OS version? And that is a technique I use in so many different cases as well, where I have some kind of interface that you can call, and then depending on the OS version, it uses different views or different code under the hood, depending on what's available.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm quite happy with the results. I'm still playing around with this to expand the capabilities for some of the new things I'll need it for. And something funny that happened while I was working on this is that, and I think this has probably happened to everyone that does development at some point, but this seemed like a new problem that I was solving. But as I was, and more towards the end, I noticed that I was actually solving an old problem, because as I was writing the layout calculations and doing some different implementations of layout calculations, because I wanted to support different distributions for the layout. So basically, I wanted it to be able to be top leading aligned and trailing and top trailing aligned, and also the same thing for bottom. I noticed that I had actually written something very similar, which is the AirBuddy desktop widgets layout calculation.
Right.
and this has not shipped in the actual release of AirBuddy yet. This is all in beta. And I mean, this new stuff is not even in beta, but the widgets are. And I went back and looked, and the solution I have for the desktop widgets layout is so much more complicated. It's like, I was looking at that, I was, who wrote this?
And that was just a few months ago.
Yeah, and I think it was. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. So I'm actually going to go back and replace that with this new solution, which is way better and has a lot of advantages over that old solution.
Isn't it funny how so much of the kind of general advice is build something not in a like super generic way first, like build it in a more specific, tailored way. Just try to solve the problem you're trying to solve first, and then look at how you can generalize it. Like that's the kind of general wisdom, right?
Yeah.
And I would say, like, in the most cases, that is true, because if you try to just generalize first, you end up with really an over-engineered solution. But in cases like this, like where you start thinking about something like a layout, like you mentioned earlier in this episode, you said, you know, you thought more about the rules of the layout, and then you implemented that. Like, that can be beneficial in situations like this, where you ended up with a simpler solution because you kind of thought about it, not just about how do I lay these widgets out, but more about the fundamental layout problems that you were trying to solve for. And then you just ended up with a solution that also solved your original problem in a simpler way.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm quite happy about that, because really, like, the new solution is way simpler and way easier to understand, and also doesn't have some of the bugs that the other solution has. So I'm really happy about that. So yeah, like the new one, I'm looking at the file here, it's like 200 lines of code, and a bunch of that is comments. So it's really not that much code at all.
That's fantastic. And that, again, I think shows the power of iterations, is that I'm such a big believer in, if you just build something and then you just, you know, call it done, and that's the best you could possibly do, that's usually not ending up with the very best version of that implementation. And of course, I'm not saying here now that every piece of code you write, you should write five times or something. That would be very, very wasteful.
Yeah.
But for more complex problems, especially if it's something that is really core to what you're trying to build, and you're, you know, it's something that really is important to you, spending like a few times over time, like iterating on it and trying out new ideas, is so beneficial and can lead to so much better implementations, because you're just discovering new things about what you're building, new tools you could use, or you just have that aha moment where you just realize, oh, this is actually way simpler than I thought it would be. And that's happened to me so many times before. And in fact, I am working on some layout things on my own now in some of my client projects, and I've actually ended up solving some of those things in way simpler ways than I first thought, where I thought I would need, you know, some really complicated custom like gesture recognizers and so on, when it turned out that I could actually just implement it using something like a scroll view, and then look at the content offset of a scroll view, and then lay out my views according to that. And then I would get all the touch handling and everything for free. So again, just by thinking about a problem a little bit longer and doing those iterations, you can actually end up with a way better implementation in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of scroll views and things like that, I think you have more to say about that, don't you?
I do. But before we get into that, we actually have a sponsor for this episode, which we are really excited to tell you about. So, Rambo, I think it's once again time to bring out the sponsor chime from your audio library and play that right now. So let's take a very quick break here to thank this episode's sponsor, which is Essential Developer. Essential Developer was founded by two senior iOS developers, Kayo and Mike, who want to help other developers reach that senior developer level. To do that, they've got an online course called the iOS Architect Crash Course, which you can sign up for completely for free by going to essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace. Now, taking that leap to fully become a senior developer can be quite tricky, since it's not just about where you've worked or for how many years you've worked, but also about learning certain key skills that senior developers are expected to have. For example, how do you effectively maintain and refactor legacy code over time? How can you avoid common anti-patterns when it comes to app architecture? And how can you apply concepts like composition in a practical way when building and maintaining apps over time? All of that and much more is exactly what Kayo and Mike will walk you through in their free online iOS Architect Crash Course. The course consists of 3 lectures, and you will also get the chance to ask your questions as well. So head over to essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace to sign up for Essential Developer's iOS Architect Crash Course today. Like I mentioned, it's completely free, and just by joining their course through that URL, you will also support Stacktrace in the process. So, win-win! But don't wait too long, because this course is only available at limited times, so make sure to sign up now if you're interested in joining. Once again, that's essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace. Thanks so much to Essential Developer for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo. So you mentioned there before the sponsor break that I have some things to share as well regarding layouts and UIs and things like that, of course, because, you know, we're doing a lot of UI development these days. And I've been really like having really fun with a lot of my client projects, like having to solve some really kind of complex layouts recently. And it's been a lot of fun. It's literally been kind of pushing my knowledge of Swift UI and UIKit to some interesting new ways, which is always cool to see that even after like a decade plus of building iOS apps, I still, you know, sometimes have to build things that are really challenging, even when using, you know, UIKit or Swift UI and technologies that I know really, really well. And that's just what I really love about app development in general, is that the kind of state of the art keeps being pushed forward, which means that as developers, we also have to kind of keep pushing ourselves to build things that are more fluid, you know, more kind of dynamic in a way when it comes to how we use things like gestures and animations. And I just find that to always be a source of challenge, which I really enjoy, and also, you know, being able to build really cool things.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely enjoy a puzzle, and I think you do as well. So, and probably most developers like a puzzle, and when we get a new problem to solve that's fairly new to us, it's always fun, and especially for me. And I know that you also enjoy, but this is really my thing, like interactions and animations and things like that. So this type of challenge is my favorite type of challenge. And even though I've solved a lot of problems in this area before, it's always challenging depending on the difficulties of the specific implementation. And one of the things which I am interested in hearing your opinion about, but we can probably talk about it after you mention everything you've done, is how to keep the code readable for this sort of thing. Because in my experience, transition code, animation code, interaction handling code is usually kind of hairy. But what have you done, John?
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about that concept kind of in general, because so often when we talk about modern UIs, we say that, oh, they should feel interactive. They should respond to your touches, right? They should follow, like, they should be fluid, right? That's another thing that is often used as a word to describe, like, think about the way you can dismiss an app and move back to the home screen on your iOS device. Like, that feels like your gesture is driving that entire interaction. And because it is, right? And then when you let go, there's an animation that kicks in, which uses the velocity of your gesture to kind of complete that animation and move you back to the home screen. So we talk a lot about that as a kind of concept. And there's a lot of expectation, I would say, from users, from designers, from clients, whoever it might be, for us as iOS developers to build those sorts of UIs. And sometimes we can get those interactions sort of for free from the OS, whether that is, you know, we're presenting a view controller modally, for example, and we get like a swipe down gesture now for free, and that is just handled by the system. There's also now the new UI sheet presentation controller API, where we can specify different detents. So we can say, you know, we want the sheet to kind of lock at certain intervals or certain positions. So there should be like a lock at around the center of the screen. So the sheet will stop there and then you can swipe it up, similar to how sort of the share sheet works on iOS and so on. So there are a lot of tools. There's also, of course, the UI View Controller interactive transitioning and those kinds of APIs available. We have drag and drop APIs. There's a lot of tools that we have in the toolbox, but how do we actually, like, what are the actual mechanics of making a UI transition feel interactive? Like, that is the big question, right? And Sometimes it can be kind of hard to know what tool to pick. So that's kind of why I want to bring up this topic, is not just to talk about some specific thing that I built, because I've worked with these APIs now for quite a while and built many different things, from custom sheets to like custom drag and drop UIs and different kind of swipe gestures, moving between UIs or changing different modes in UIs. And I feel like this is just becoming more and more common in iOS app in general, is to, you know, build these very, very gesture-driven UIs. So I just thought it would be fun to spend some time just talking about that, and definitely also discuss the topic you brought up there on how to make the code readable, because like you said, especially when you have to kind of mix this kind of dynamicness and these transitions, these interactive transitions, with tools like auto layout, for example, like that can be really challenging, because auto layout wants you to declare this kind of graph of constraints up front. But then when you have something that you are just interacting with dynamically, like how do you update all the constraints dynamically? That is usually not great for performance. So how do you kind of make sure those two worlds play well together? That is usually a challenge as well.
Yeah, I like to summarize a lot of those characteristics you mentioned into responsiveness. So I like to talk about the UI being responsive. And what I mean by that is all you mentioned, like it's fast, it doesn't hang, interactions feel like you're actually doing the interaction and not like your finger is driving some abstract thing that might look like an interaction, which happens sometimes. And yeah, you mentioned using Springboard on iOS as an example, and that's an example I use as well. And in general, like most of Apple's iOS apps, you can use as a good example. Of course, there are some examples that are not like that. I'm looking at you, music. Yeah, not every Apple app is super responsive, but most of the built-in apps on iOS are. And a test I like to do in my iOS apps, and we're talking about iOS because you use it with your fingers, so it's more imperative that they be extremely responsive. Not that it doesn't matter on the desktop, but with your fingers, it's even more important. So the test I do a lot and that I recommend people do with their own apps, and you can try that with Apple's built-in apps on iOS and then try some third-party apps to compare them, is go through the app really quickly. Like open something and then really quickly close it. Like pretend like you open something by mistake and you just want to go back as quickly as possible. Are you able to do that? Can you try to open something and then in the middle of the transition, you realize that that's not what you want and you can go back? I would guess that like probably over 90% of third-party apps on iOS do not handle that case. You have to wait for the thing you tapped on to finish transitioning, or even worse, loading from a server, to then be able to go back and cancel out. And at least in most of iOS itself, system UI and built-in apps, you tend to be able to just keep going and go back really quickly. Like I think Springboard is a great example. If you tap an app icon and you swipe up really quickly because you've realized that's not what you wanted, it immediately goes back and lets you pick another one. So that's a test I highly recommend. Just go through your app really quickly and see if it's responsive.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good exercise. And I think when you build your own solutions on top of existing Apple-provided solutions or system behaviors, you get a lot of this for free. Like, for example, if you use UI Sheet Presentation Controller to present a custom sheet, you get all of those behaviors with being able to swipe down, being able to do interruptible gestures and so on, like you've talked about. And if you use something like UI View Controller Interactive Transitioning and you implement that, then you can drive those kind of interactive transitions in a way that integrates really well with the system, so that when the user swipes back, for example, in Navigation Controller and, you know, uses these gestures that we're all kind of getting muscle memory for now, right? Like, because we've been using it for so many years, that still all works. So I think the general advice, or what I try to do at least, is I always try to find these built-in solutions that I can use first. If I need to build something custom, like, can I base it on an existing solution? And sometimes that might even be like using something like UI Scroll View, like I mentioned here earlier, to drive my transition or my interaction. Like, for example, if I'm building something where the user should be able to scroll through something like a product page, but it's not necessarily like an just a scroll view with some content in it. Maybe it uses something more custom in terms of the presentation. Maybe different items kind of come into view as the user goes and scrolls. Then I can use the scroll view as kind of the driver for that interaction, and I can read the content offset using the UI scroll view delegate, and then I can decide what to hide or show depending on the current content offset. So an example of this, which is kind of popular in different apps, is you have these headers, right? Where the headers collapse when you scroll down. And that's also a behavior now that is quite commonly found across Apple's apps and in the OS as well. When you have these large header titles, like navigation bar titles, and then they collapse when you scroll down. If you want to mimic that in a custom header, then you can use the content offset as the driver instead of using just animations that you're saying like UIView.animate with a specific duration, because that can conflict with the user's intent of scrolling. You just have everything be driven by the current content offset. Then that will look animated when the user scrolls down because, well, the scroll animation is kind of what is driving your layout as well. So I found that to be also a useful technique rather than going in and implementing my own kind of gesture recognizers and my own animation code, to try to find somewhere where I can hook into the system, whether it's an explicit API like UIView controller interactive transitioning, or becoming like the UI scroll view or table view delegate and driving my own layouts and animations and interactions based on those.
Yeah, definitely. And the example you gave is one that I see many apps getting wrong, in fact, when they do something where there's a header that collapses. Sometimes the layout is changing in not in sync with the scroll view. So you scroll a little bit and then it kind of like, it's kind of like it's pulling your finger in a sense, and it just goes up and jumps away from you. That's really terrible. But it happens a lot. So I think your approach of driving things in that way is a good one. And you kind of get this stuff with experience as well. Something I didn't realize for a long time before I did more of this work is that a scroll gesture is already an animation, like you mentioned. So
right,
you don't have to animate stuff that's being driven by a scroll gesture unless you want to, when the scroll gesture ends, decide if you want to maybe collapse completely or expand or stay where you are. Then sometimes if a user lifts their finger, then you want to actually perform an animation. But even then, many times, the scroll view will still be in the momentum phase of the scroll. So it has momentum and deceleration, and it works as an animation. So you have to keep that stuff in mind when you are integrating things with something like a scroll view.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And UI scroll view delegate also is such a rich protocol. It has like, I would say it's almost like a dream protocol when it comes to delegation. Like, it gives you all of the events. Like, so it gives you events like the scroll view will end dragging, and it gives you the velocity of the drag and everything. So you can use that to drive any of your own custom animations to have them be completely in sync with the scrolling animation itself. Or, like I mentioned, you could just let the content offset decide, because that will just naturally kind of decelerate as the user stops scrolling. The content offset will like be reduced or increased in a different acceleration, right? So yep, if you just drive everything based on that, then that will kind of solve that problem. And I think, you know, you mentioned a good test was to kind of use the app and go through it as quickly as possible to see, are my interactions really fluid here? And I think when you're doing anything that relates to scrolling, one good test to do is to kind of do the opposite, to see, you know, if you scroll your scroll view like one pixel at a time, you know, like really, really slowly, does all of your interactions and animations and these things feel good even at that low velocity? Because if they do, then they tend to work really well regardless of velocity. But if you have a lot of things where, you know, you start animating and you were assuming that, you know, 0.2 seconds is going to be fast enough because the user is scrolling, well, if the user is scrolling really slowly, maybe that scroll will take like 3 seconds instead. So that kind of, I think, teaches, or taught me at least, to break so many of those assumptions and to really base it more on the data that the scroll view gives me rather than on, you know, some kind of specific intervals that I've kind of made up on myself. And also, like when doing that, you mentioned code readability earlier. And I feel like when you just base something on such a kind of single source of truth, whether it's the content offset, whether it's the velocity of a gesture, whether it's like the context you get from an interactive transition and, you know, the percentage of the transition that has been completed, whether it's something like a sheet presentation and you want to base it on the amount that the sheets have been presented. If you can find that kind of single variable or a couple of variables that you are basing your interaction on, then the code can become so much more readable, because then it just becomes kind of like a standard algorithm of the variables as input and the current state of the transition as output, which you can even test if you want to, which is really, really cool. And it becomes more like just pure math instead of being this complex state machine where you have all these variables and things. You can kind of write the code in a way where, you know, you're checking, like, is the content offset, for example, above this threshold? And you can name things with nice constants to make things readable. Then it becomes much more easier to read, I would say.
Yeah, that's a great approach. And by the way, you mentioned the scroll view deceleration and things like that. There is actually a UI scroll view dot deceleration rate type.
Right.
And it has both a normal and fast. I've never seen fast being used anywhere. I've only seen normal. But that's actually a constant that you can use in your own calculations. So if for some reason you need to have deceleration in some custom mechanic you're implementing in your app, you can use that constant for your calculation and plug it into an algorithm, which we can actually share. There's a great article by Ilya, and that article talks about the math used to calculate the scroll view deceleration, and you can use that in your own animations and transitions. So if you have, say, a spring animation and you want to figure out the right velocity to input into that spring animation, then you can use this basic formula and use that constant of the UI scroll view deceleration rate, and you'll get something that feels natural to any iOS user.
Yeah, and this again goes back to like trying to build your interactions on top of system APIs as much as possible, even if it's just using that constant from UI scroll view, because it's something that users will recognize. And it might not seem like a super important detail to get like the deceleration rate or the animation rate exactly right, but it really is. Because even if you're off by just like some minor detail or some, you know, couple of milliseconds, or in the case of deceleration, like the constant is just like some decimal points wrong, then that can end up feeling broken. Like, or it, and maybe not broken, maybe that's too harsh, but it can end up feeling not native, and it can end up feeling strange to those users, like many of us listeners, who have that muscle memory of iOS interactions, and you just want those to feel the same even when you're dealing with something custom. And that's also another thing, is like, you know, I don't think the advice should be only use Apple's predefined APIs like UI Sheet Presentation Controller, because otherwise your users will think that your interactions feel alien. I don't think that really works, because sometimes you need to build something that's custom because you want a custom layout or custom behaviors. And I think we've talked about this many times before, that rather than hacking some system provided solution to fit some specific use case, it's usually better to try to build something separate, but then building it on top of system components so you get the same behaviors to a large extent, but you still have a custom solution, rather than going in and, you know, iterating over the subviews and removing some subviews, because what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, definitely. Also, something that I think this is actually going a bit beyond everything we talked about here is, if you do things the way we mentioned here and you approach things this way, you're probably going to have a very responsive and fluid and really nice to use app and interactions. But if you want to go even beyond and have something that feels extremely natural, you can also do something that Apple does everywhere, which I think the term they use is retargeting. So basically, let's say you are in an app on iOS, and people who are listening, if you have an iPhone without a home button, or even an iPad without a home button, you can do this. If you swipe up to close the app and you throw it towards the middle of the screen, it will jump up a little bit and then fly into its icon. But if you do it a little bit to the side, so like a little bit to the right or the left, the app will actually go a little bit to the left before it retargets, and that's where the name comes from, and goes into its destination. And it's very subtle. It's not like the app is flying outside the screen and then flying back in, but it's very subtle. It changes the trajectory, and that makes it feel supernatural, like it, almost like the app is a little ball you're throwing in the screen. So you can also do that. And I don't think I've done it with property animators or UI kits in general. I've adopted this more as I've transitioned to Swift UI. So I'm not sure, but I believe UI view property animator can do that sort of thing if you change the parameters mid animation. So yeah, that's also something I highly recommend if you can go a little bit over and make it even better and more natural, is to implement those sorts of like retargeting animations.
Yeah, and when you hear us talk about this, it might now seem like you need to implement like a full physics simulation into your app in order to drive an animation, but that's usually not the case. Like a lot of these things are smoke and mirrors.
Yep.
I mean, sometimes there is like some physics simulation. I mean, there's that UI kit dynamics, I believe it's called, right? Where you can add actual physics behaviors to your views and so on, like iMessage bubbles, like move around and so on. But a lot of like these kinds of physically based animations you can achieve with a couple of different tools. Like the first of them is interruptible animations, like you talked about, like using UI view property animator rather than just creating a linear animation and playing that, you have a more dynamic animation that can be interrupted and mutated as the animation is going. So that's number one. Then you have things like spring animations with velocity, which give you so much more kind of, It feels much more natural that the animation is playing out rather than just doing, again, a linear animation. And then you have animation curves, which you can also add to give a little bit more bounce to your animation. And if you play around with these different parameters and you do things like retargeting, like you mentioned, and you perhaps have different phases of the animation, like in the beginning, you just use the direction of the user's touch when they were using something like a UI pan gesture recognizer. You get like the translation and the velocity, and you start the animation that way. And then mid animation, you retarget and you move towards the target. And if you do that right and you play around with those parameters, you can end up with something that feels like it's almost like a physics simulation, but it's not. It's just that you added some nice parameters to make the animation feel much more natural, even though it's actually just not a pre-computer animation, but it's not actually doing physics simulation. It's just doing interpolation under the hood.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to get right, and that's all basically a few math functions that you can use and basically playing around with parameters like you mentioned. But the most important thing to get right with these sorts of animations that start from an interaction is to get the velocity right.
Yeah.
If you get the initial velocity right, it just feels right. And I think over time, you developed a sense of what feels right. So when I'm tweaking this sort of thing, I know that the velocity is not right. Usually, if by the time I finish my swipe or whatever gesture that I'm doing, if it feels like there's a little hang in the animation, like it doesn't really continue from my gesture, you will get a feel that it doesn't really continue from the gesture. It feels like it's either jumping, so that means the velocity is too high, or it's like breaking in the middle of the animation, and that's when you know the velocity is too low. And of course, the velocity will be based on the gesture velocity itself.
Yeah, so you can get that from UI pan gesture recognizer. You can get the velocity of the gesture. You can get it from UI scroll view delegate, like we talked about. So whenever there is a system interaction that involves this kind of panning gesture where you're like scrolling or moving across the screen, you can get the velocity for that and base your animation on that. Because like what you're saying here, Rambo, I feel like another way to describe it is that you want the handoff between the gesture and the animation to be seamless, right? Yep. Like you can't notice it. You don't feel like you stop your interaction, then an animation starts playing like a movie. You want it to just be a continuation of your gesture.
Yeah, exactly. And you will find in some places on iOS where the transition is not fully interactive. So you will drive it starting out from a gesture, but at some point an animation will take over. I think this missing the now playing screen in the music app is like that. And that's fine. Like if that works for your app, I don't feel like that's terrible. In some places, it might not make sense for the whole thing to be interactive. So sometimes you might be doing this where the handoff is not entirely controlled by the user, but at some point you decide, okay, it's time to dismiss now. I'll just go away and not wait for the user to lift their finger, basically. But yeah, in most cases, if you can do it fully interactive, it will definitely feel a lot better. And I think I mentioned this in the animations talk that I gave at BA Swiftable a while back. You'll know that you got it right if you've been playing around with it for a few minutes on your device and you don't even see like the time go by and you catch yourself playing around with it. I think that's when you know you got it right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to briefly here mention also before we wrap up, like, I feel like this is also a type of situation where you might also want to make different choices when it comes to how you construct your layout. So even though you might be using something like Auto Layout or even Swift UI or something for this part of the app where you're building this type of interaction, for the actual interaction calculations, you might sometimes want to just say, let me, quote unquote, go back to manually calculated frames here. Let me actually calculate these things myself using my own algorithm, like we talked about. Because if you try, at least this is what I found, if you try to make these kind of very, very dynamic interactions, like completely kind of hook into both like Auto Layout and sometimes the Swift UI layout system and so on, that can just give you that overhead that causes those glitches and causes that stuttering that you really want to avoid. While if you keep things very, very simple in a way and contained, where you are just assigning the frames and things directly on what you're trying to animate, that can end up sometimes being smoother. Of course, this is not a universal truth. So sometimes, you know, you can, for example, update the constants of a layout constraint and then animate over that using, you know, the layout if needed method and so on. And that can end up feeling just as responsive. So I'm not saying that never use Auto Layout for interactive transitions, but it's just something to keep in mind that if you find yourself like when profiling that if the layout tool that you're currently using has kind of too much of a cost when it comes to performance in that particular interaction, I also personally sometimes say, okay, I'm actually going to go back to manual calculated frames here just to kind of remove that as a potential performance bottleneck.
Yeah, for within a screen, if it's not like a full-blown whole screen transition, you can also use a hybrid approach. And that's what I've done in Chibi Studio. We have the toolbar within the editor, and it can be thrown from one side of the screen to the other. So it can basically has two attachment points. And it is, the whole screen does use Auto Layout. And the way I've done it is when you are interacting with the toolbar and dragging it around, I basically detach it from its parent, the current docking station, which is what I call them. And when you finish the interaction and it knows where it will be attached to, it will animate to that frame. And at the end of the animation, it will reattach itself to the destination docking station with Auto Layout. So basically, Auto Layout is not used during the interaction. Auto Layout is quote, turned off during the interaction, and then it's turned back on within the given docking station for the toolbar. So that hybrid approach does work, and it sounds really complicated, but it's basically like deactivating a bunch of constraints and then reactivating the right constraints when you decide where it should land. And that's way better than trying to calculate the different constants for the different constraints and figuring out how to make them animate properly without being super slow.
Exactly, because you don't want to end up in a situation where you're essentially writing this kind of imperative frame-based layout code but using Auto Layouts, right? Because Then you're like using the wrong tool for the job, essentially. And another hybrid approach that I've used many times also is that you might encapsulate the thing that is moving around and transitioning in something like a custom view, and then you are setting the frame of that, but then inside of that custom view, you're using Auto Layout to lay out the subviews, right? That also works really, really well.
Yep.
So you can find different ways to say, let me get all the advantages of using Auto Layout with the constraints and all of the power you get from that. Or in the case of Swift UI, let me take like a UI hosting controller and place my Swift UI views in there and then use UI Kit to actually drive the interaction. That's something that can also be possible depending on what you're building. So I sometimes find these hybrid approaches as well, where I get all the benefits from using the layout tool that I like to use while still enabling high performance in the actual transition.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. So I think we managed to cover quite a lot of ground there regarding interactive transitions. And of course, there will be a lot of links in the show notes to these different APIs that we talked about. And we also love to get questions as well from you, our listeners. So if you have anything that you would like us to dive deeper into in a future episode or any other topic you want to suggest, or maybe just want to give us some feedback around the show or tell us what you like or what you want to see more about or hear more about on the show, I guess, then feel free to contact us. We always love to hear from our listeners. And probably the best place to reach us these days is probably on Mastodon, right, Rambo?
Absolutely. I am at _inside on mastodon.social.
And I am at Johnson Dell on mastodon.social. And you can also ask us any question you'd like by emailing us at ask@stacktracepodcast.fm. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is for us to once again thank this episode's great sponsor, which were Essential Developer. Head over to essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace to sign up for that iOS Architect crash course that they have there and help support our podcast. But that's it for this episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.